Feeding Matters Infant and Child Feeding Questionnaire was developed as an evidence-based tool to promote early identification of feeding disorders. Developed by internationally recognized feeding experts, this online questionnaire, available in both English and Spanish, can help you better understand your child's feeding differences and needs. Take it online for free today at questionnaire.feedingmatters.org. That's questionnaire.feedingmatters.org. Or type ICFQ in your search bar.
Presented by Feeding Matters with hosts Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Welcome to Feeding Does Matter. My name is Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
Hi, and I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNC Wilmington. How are you doing today, Jacqueline?
I have a day of back-to-back meetings, so I'm doing pretty well. But how are you doing?
You're doing a lot. Yeah, I'm doing well. That's great. I don't think I have quite back-to-back today, but I'm keeping busy here.
It is too. A busy day.
Yeah, we're well into the summer semester. Yeah, doing some evidence-based practice projects. That's great.
Oh, that's
we're getting into it. Yeah.
Well, today we have a special guest that's part of our 20th anniversary interview series. And so, Haley, you just met her in our kind of like our pre-show, but I'm excited to introduce her to all of you. Liz Goodman is on the line with us. And Liz has been a longtime supporter of Feeding Matters, has known us for, I believe, I mean, you'll have to share how long you've known us, but a very long time. Served on the board, served as a volunteer, chair of a fundraising event, pro bono lobbyist for us in many different capacities, and a huge strategic advisor. As well as a parent. So Liz, who is an attorney and healthcare lobbyist, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be on. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, we're excited to chat with you today. So maybe before we get into kind of what brought you to Feeding Matters and your daughter, maybe just share a little bit about your professional background, just because it is so relevant to even your own personal lived experience story.
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. So I am an attorney, but most of my day consists of lobbying at the Capitol. So sort of traditional going down to the legislature in Arizona, talking to legislators about all kinds of things. We do kind of focus on healthcare issues. But we have all kinds of clients, anything from education to transportation and infrastructure, water, you know, all kinds of things. But really, my passion is healthcare, and I really focused on healthcare in law school. So we represent American Heart Association, Blue Cross Blue Shield, a couple of other smaller nonprofits. And so I get to go down to the legislature every day and talk about important healthcare issues and access to care. And it's great. I love it a lot. Wouldn't want to do anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like you keep very busy with that as well. I'm sure that's just like a go, go, go job.
Yeah, it's so fun. It's so great. Not all of us lobbyists are bad. We kind of have a bad reputation from things like tobacco, you know, and guns, but really, the work I do is so meaningful, and it helps me sleep at night, and we make a difference in everyday lives. So it's really great.
Yeah, you really do. So then maybe share with whatever you're comfortable about kind of your story, even before you found Feeding Matters.
I'd love to. So my daughter was born in 2014. She was born slightly premature. She was actually born technically on the 37th week of gestation, so it's not considered premature, but I had something called IUGR, which is intrauterine growth restriction, and that resulted in her not growing inside me in the way that she needed to be. So sort of a delicate balance that we were taking with the obstetrician about when to take her out. And we ended up doing an emergency C-section on exactly the 37th day, or 37th week. She was supposed to go directly into the NICU, and the NICU nurses were there waiting for her. But she got an 8 and then a 9 on the APGAR. Her lungs were fully developed. She was about 4.5 pounds. And so we kind of just hung out in the hospital until she was big enough to leave, which was 5 pounds. I think we were there for a week and a half. She came home and was totally healthy and normal and was able to latch and breastfeed. And then the early stages of our solid feeding went really well, exactly according to plan. She was able to eat solid foods from 6 months to a year. And then right about at a year, she started refusing all solid foods. So she would eat purees and she would drink liquids, but she wouldn't eat anything that sort of required chewing or had any texture to it, which was really odd considering she was fine with it for the first 6 months. It was almost like a switch flipped, and she went from being a very good, strong eater to highly problematic. And so I immediately approached the pediatrician about it. At the same time, she was sort of starting to miss milestones. So she was late in holding up her head. She became late in crawling, late in walking. So I started to get concerned and approached the pediatrician. The pediatrician just said, you know, this is all very normal and she'll get back to eating normally and nothing to be concerned about. And the issue persisted to the point where I felt like I needed to seek outside care, and I wasn't really getting a lot of help or support from the pediatrician. So I sought out SARC, which at the time really was the only place I knew to go. I did some research and I found out that feeding issues and delayed milestones could be signs of autism. So we went to SARC at about age 2. And they diagnosed us with at risk of autism, not autism yet, because I think she was too young at the time, but did refer us to PCH for a lot of sort of outpatient rehab care, including feeding and OT and PT. Yeah.
Can you say what PCH is?
Yes. Sorry about that. Phoenix Children's Hospital in Arizona. And so they were great. They, you know, they definitely said she does need all these therapies, feeding included. And we did outpatient rehab for several years, especially for feeding. We did it for many, many years, both at PCH and then outside of PCH. And we made little bits of progress, but not huge progress. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you fast forward to today, she's 11. She'll be 12 in October. And she still has major feeding issues. She only eats a few things, maybe 10 or so things. She sees a nutritionist, and we've transferred her now to a doctor who specializes in eating disorders because she's starting to sort of exhibit some signs of concern, ARFID concern, and body dysmorphia and weight issues. So we want to sort of address that before it becomes a bigger issue. But she still only eats a very limited amount of foods, you know, has major, major sensory sensitivities when it comes to things like smells, textures, sights. So, you know, we're still working through it and still haven't quite found the solution. But she does eat some solid foods, which, you know, is a huge win compared to many other families. I found Feeding Matters, I want to say around age 2 or 3. And I don't even remember how I found you guys, Jacqueline. I know.
I was trying to think about that in preparing this. Because was it through the Children's Hospital or was it an word of mouth? Because I think you found either Chris Lynn, our former CEO, or Shannon Goldwater, our founder. Like you almost, didn't you get connected to one of them before you even found Feeding Matters?
Yes, I was connected to Chris. That's right. It's coming back to me. So I think I was connected to Chris through a personal connection. And then I started to realize that it was strange that I hadn't been referred to you guys by any of the various doctors that I had met with. And so one of the things we started talking about early on was how do we get providers to immediately think of Feeding Matters when there's a feeding issue? Mm-hmm.
You know, like
any provider, you know, obviously for sure the Phoenix Children's Hospital, but also just everyday pediatricians should be, you know, hearing about feeding issues and immediately referring to Feeding Matters. And that wasn't happening at the time. Hopefully it's happening more now, but
there's definitely progress. I do think it's an ongoing thing. The other thing that we hear, honestly, Liz, and I would love your feedback on this too, is that even if a parent is told about Feeding Matters, you're just in so much as a place of overwhelm, and there's just so much to do that it can be hard to like we've had people say, you know, I wrote Feeding Matters down and I didn't find it in my journal till 6 months later because it felt overwhelming at the time. So that's also the area that we navigate too, is like, how do we support these parents in such a fragile place when they're trying to find the support that they need?
Mm-hmm. You're literally struggling day to day just to get proper nutrients into your child, who's often failure to thrive, you know, and then there's often other comorbidities like we had, you know, related to delayed walking and delayed talking. And so those are also concerning items. And so you have this huge long list of potential people that can help, you know, and half of them don't take insurance and half of them are not taking new patients. And so you do get fatigued sort of trying to figure out, how should I prioritize these needs and who should I call first and where do I go and what do I ask for? It's really overwhelming. And as I was sitting in the waiting room every day at PCH, Phoenix Children's Hospital, I was meeting parents who, you know, were struggling with so many different things, like some of them just basically putting food on the table and keeping a roof over their head. There's so much poverty. And so adding this onto the plates of parents who, you know, are barely making ends meet or living paycheck to paycheck is just, I truly can't imagine, you know, because it's hard for parents like me who have resources. And I just can't imagine how anybody else who's struggling in so many other ways can possibly navigate the system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was going to be one of my questions, because I think you came at this from a level of having at least a bit of understanding of like legal jargon, able to kind of understand the healthcare system, understanding health in general, like the healthcare insurance side, all of that. How did you kind of approach navigating such a complicated system? And yes, knowing that families are really at a loss if they can't do that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was so hard for me that I truly can't even imagine what it's like for other families, because I had resources, you know, I had friends who were physicians at Phoenix Children's Hospital and friends who were BCBAs and, you know, all kinds of people that I could just call on. And still with all of that at my fingertips, I was lost, you know, especially on the feeding piece.
Yeah.
Because I really felt like, you know, on the OT work that we were doing and on the PT work that we were doing, she was making incredible progress. And on the feeding side of things, she wasn't making progress then, and she's made very little progress now. So it's almost like even if you have all the resources at your fingertips, you still don't really know what to do, you know, and you're seeing the best providers, best therapists, and there's still not really any progress being made. So, you know, it's incredibly hard and frustrating, but I know that I come from a place of privilege and was able to get into the best providers, you know, and I don't know how families do it that don't, you know, have those, you know, those relationships and people who can pick up the phone and make calls for you and figure out and navigate who the best providers are and who you need to see and how to jump the line and how to get in and how to get insurance paid for. It's just so complicated.
And the fact that there is a really long line, know, development is so critical, and we see wait lists over several months to a year plus for a lot of places, both specialists and particular programs.
Yeah. And Dr. Dana Williams, who I know you know, Jacqueline, is kind of considered the best provider in town for feeding issues, because it's really, you know, feeding can really be a multidisciplinary problem that involves several people sitting at the table, navigating it and figuring it out. You know, and Dr. Williams, who's a GI doctor, understands that and knows who to bring to the table and knows how to involve different disciplines. And she's hard to get into. You know, she's just...
She's only one person for a whole state.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So while you brought her up, I'm also going to just like celebrate her a little bit. She is so passionate. She is chair of our medical education. I'm going to get the name wrong, but Medical Education Task Force, I believe it is. But it's working on getting PFD and feeding development curriculum into medical schools and residency programs to be able to kind of catch that early in terms of like as a physician's learning about this, to be able to know that they need to be asking about feeding and that it looks a little bit different than they may have been formally taught.
Yeah, that's huge, because the reality is that you can't blame these pediatricians for not intervening early, because a lot of times they're not even provided basic education on this in medical.
They don't know what they don't know.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as you navigated a lot of this, did you come upon any like insurance barriers and have to do appeals or anything like that? I know that that's a very common thing that our families experience as well.
You know what? I was very lucky in that we got connected to PCH through SARC early on, and we were able to sort of get like a warm handoff to PCH, which was really nice. And it made me really glad I did go to SARC early on. But I think when we saw SARC early on, and you probably want to know what SARC stands for.
Also. I do. Yeah.
I'm drawing a blank.
It's Southwest Autism Research and Resource Center. I may have gotten the R's
sort
wrong.
Of the largest sort of autism provider and research center in the state.
And the Southwest.
Mm-hmm. In the Southwest. Yeah. So they were the only ones I knew to call. When the pediatrician didn't know what to do and sort of, frankly, ignored my concerns, SARC was the only thing I had ever heard of. Autism was the only thing I could possibly connect with what was going on with my child. Right. And so it was the only place I knew to call. So I
think these things are helpful for other families listening so they can perhaps connect the dots for their child. Okay.
Yeah. So even though SARC wasn't able to provide an autism diagnosis, they were able to provide these very valuable resources and referrals for me that I wouldn't have known to look for and go to without them. And they didn't take insurance. So that was sort of the first step for me. And it was a cash pay situation.
It's a very common thing. Another challenge in terms of families that can't pay.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So two things. I mean, one is that I had no idea who to call to ask for help. And I just happened to know of SARC because I'm sort of in the healthcare community. And if you wouldn't know of SARC and you don't know about autism, where are you even going to start if your pediatrician turns you away? And then second is you've got to be able to pay cash pay at some point during sort of the trajectory of care that you're referred to, because a lot of these providers just don't take insurance, you know? And so for families who don't have the resources, don't have the expertise, don't have the knowledge, and don't have, you know, extra funds laying around to pay cash pay, I truly don't know what they do.
Yeah. It's just one of those things that makes me sit up at night sometimes, especially with what we're seeing happen with a lot of insurance and coverage in general, that it continues to be a challenge and is getting worse in a lot of cases.
I mean, I developed these relationships with these families that were sitting in the waiting room day after day, week after week with me, waiting for the same appointments that we were going to, and heard their personal stories about how hard this has been on their family and, you know, how hard it was just to find care in the first place, and that care was delayed because it, you know, it took so long to figure out where to go and to get in, you know, and a lot of this is early intervention is really key, you know, and so just the really tragic, you know, personal anecdotes and struggles and stories I heard really sort of made me want to figure out how to do more and how to find these families early when they need you the most, and then have Feeding Matters sort of be the conduit to step in and help find, you know, where can you go that takes insurance? Where can you go that will get you in right away and take you seriously? And I think if a family can land with Feeding Matters early on, their life becomes so much easier because you can provide those resources to them. And those are the resources we're all desperately looking for and don't know where to find.
Yeah. And it's hard to know, because I think sometimes too, at the age of the internet and even AI, like you're getting thrown a lot of information and it's hard to know what information to trust or to follow. And hopefully we can be that kind of partner in that journey that you're walking.
Yeah. And it's so overwhelming. It's like you're paralyzed because you're just trying to get basic nutrients into your child. And that becomes a full-time job all day, every day.
Yeah. Multiple times a day.
Yeah. And you're totally stressed about it. And your child's already been diagnosed with failure to thrive. You're just trying to hit these weight milestones. And it's like, it's the one thing in child rearing that you can't really truly control. Mm-hmm. You want to get food and nutrients in your child so badly, but you can't do it because they reject. You know what I mean? And so it's like, it's terrifying and all consuming. And so it's like, yeah, how are you going to sit down and spend time and go buy books and sit on ChatGPT or Google and sort of figure out what the answers are when you're really just completely paralyzed and can't do anything because all you're thinking about is getting basic nutrients in your child?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And compound that with what maybe a pediatrician is telling you, that's it's a phase or
right.
Or you it's your anxiety or.
Yes. I had a really bad, Jacqueline knows this, but I had a really bad sort of gaslighting experience with my first pediatrician. Luckily, we were able to move her care to PCH and it was much better. But it sort of felt like I was the one going crazy and that I was making this up. And, you know, it was not helpful at all.
No, it's not helpful to what you guys needed at the time.
No. Right. Yeah. But. How did the first helpful things happen for you?
Good question.
How did the first helpful or good things happen for you all?
Yeah. So the good things really started happening when we got to PCH because they really took one look at my daughter, Ellie, and said, yeah, she really needs these interventions right now, like yesterday. And we're going to.
Well, how did you get there?
You got there through SARC. So,
okay.
Yeah. So SARC said, you know, we're not at a point where we can diagnose her with autism. And frankly, we don't know if this is autism, but we can see from this evaluation, which was like a one full day or maybe half day eval, you know, we can see that she needs interventions now. And so rather than my pediatrician sort of looking at me and saying, like, why are you wasting my time again with this? She's fine. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, she's just, the pediatrician was sort of like, she's just a picky eater. Be patient. She's going to get over this. SARC was like, I'm taking you seriously. We see that there's a need here, not just for feeding, but for, you know, a full continuum of care. So we need to get you into GI right away, but we also need to get you into, you know, these other sort of related outpatient rehab programs like PT, because they also took seriously the milestone she was missing. So it was like the first time, and she was two, you know, and I felt like I had been fighting for a year to find out what to do with her. So it was really
the
first time that someone said, yeah, your concerns are valid and we need to get you help, which was huge.
That's good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That should have been coming through early intervention.
Well, and the interesting one of the interesting things that happened is that SARC also told us about AZIP, which is Arizona. This is another acronym. I think it's Arizona.
Yeah, Arizona's Early Intervention Program.
Right. Yeah. That's really how this is supposed to happen. I think in most states, that the pediatrician is the first point of contact. The pediatrician identifies the need for early intervention and gets the family set up with early intervention through the state. And the state is really supposed to be the guide here on how do we get you what you need early so that your child has the best chance of succeeding and getting caught up. And that program really fell through the cracks for us. We applied twice and we were denied both times.
I was going to say, I don't know that you guys would have qualified. We have a pretty limited qualification. Yeah, it's like 70 or 80%. It's a significant delay before someone. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that is, you were a candidate for it, but didn't get the services.
And I was sort of like, my child's not eating, she's not talking, and she's not walking, you know, and she's a year and a half. So, like, how severe can you possibly be to need these services? This is insane. But that's one area where my policy brain really kicks in, and I think a lot of states are much more generous in their qualifications for early intervention programs. And I think that's somewhere that we really need to get to in Arizona, because really, if you think about it long term, that produces so much savings for the state, you know, because with autism and with so many other issues and developmental delays, catching it early is absolutely fundamental to a child's long term success. You know, and so to really not invest in that early identification and treatment is just so short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the point.
Yeah, that's the exact point of, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Liz, you have been through a lot with Ellie, and a lot of parents, I'm sure, can relate to your story. How or what advice might you share with them about, A, how to advocate for themselves? Because I do find that you're such a great advocate for yourself and for Ellie and the needs that you both have. Yeah. But some people struggle to find that advocacy and empowerment within themselves.
Yeah. So I learned at a very early point in parenthood that you have to be your child's best advocate and no one else is going to do that for you. And if you feel like your provider is not listening and not hearing you and not taking you seriously, you've got to move on and find another provider or just be a very firm vocal advocate with that provider. And I was scared because I was, you know, a first-time mom and, you know, you're sort of, it's sort of scary to you know, challenge a provider. When
yeah, there's a different power struggle there.
It's a power struggle and you're not a clinician, you know. Mm-hmm. A lot of moms are not clinicians. I'm not a clinician. But I am a mom with strong mom instincts. You know what I mean? And I wish I had followed my instincts more because I feel like that 6 months was so critical where I really kind of at a year and a half knew that something was wrong, but just didn't do anything about it because my provider, you know, the PCP, the pediatrician was telling me everything's fine.
Yeah. I mean, but you were listening to the expert. That's not on you. You thought you could listen to the expert to wait and see.
But I think my advice to parents is you can't always listen to the expert because the expert doesn't always know what's best. And she now sees an incredible team of providers, including Taylor, who is her nutritionist, and Dr. Conrad, who is, you may know of Dr. Conrad, actually.
I think so.
She is formerly with PCH, PCH and started the Conrad Clinic, which is a clinic for kids with ARFID, PFD, and eating disorders. And so Dr. Conrad has sort of provided us with all kinds of referrals, including Taylor. And Taylor's really working with Ellie to kind of understand. I think one thing that works really well for Ellie now that she's older is she's understanding the science behind nutrition at this point. So she's learning about why you need proteins and why you need carbohydrates and why you need fruits and veggies and what that balance does for your body and what the nutrients and the vitamins that are in those foods do for your body. And she's really absorbing the importance of that. And so that to her is now motivation to try new things, which I think for younger kids won't necessarily be and wasn't for her.
Yeah.
But now reaching this later trajectory, it's been really beneficial. So adding sort of this nutritionist element into our care has been huge.
Yeah, it's a piece of learning. And that's, yeah. I mean, like, I think, too, as we pursue, like, feeding development to be its own early childhood developmental domain, we really want people to reconceptualize that feeding is something to be learned. And if mm-hmm. at all in that journey you're having a negative experience, it's going to take that much longer. But then there's still more to learn. Like, we're all learning a lot about nutrition as adults, too.
But just going to say, I went on a walk last night with one of my neighbors who is a dietitian nutritionist and was learning from her just about like a balance, like a B complex balance that might help me get more energy because I might not be getting it from my main food sources. So yeah, this is something that really needs to be taught and we really need to do a better job of incorporating this, I think, not only in medical school, but in nursing school, but also just in like basic elementary school, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So that we can all kind of be aware and that it's a part of the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anything that we didn't ask you that you've been thinking about in terms of your history with Feeding Matters or where you see the future of this world going? I know that you've got lots of ideas that you've always helped us think through what's yeah. on our cookie list for policy changes.
Yeah, I think, you know, I will always sort of come from this unique place of policy versus...
No, it's what I love about it. I just wish we could raise the money to make it happen.
Yeah, the problem is that, you know, this needs to be a much more recognized condition nationally and among national insurance, both on the Medicaid and commercial side. And I think to do that, you need to do a lot of policy work at the national level with CMS, Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, and, you know, all of the entities that oversee provider care and insurance. And I think that really is what's going to make a huge difference, you know, making sure these things are all covered across Medicaid and commercial health, making sure that feeding issues are taught and required to be taught in a basic medical school and nursing school curriculum. And this is all policy work that really needs to be done at a national level. So there's a lot of work to be done. But I think, no, Jacqueline, I think you see it and understand the work that needs to be done. And now it's really just about fundraising and getting support and commitment and growing this organization, because this organization is going to be the group that does it.
Thanks, Liz. Yeah. It's been crazy to think about it being 20 years, because it's like, you know, I'm almost conflicted in the sense that, like, there's still so much that needs to be done. But we've also come so far in just, like, having a whole field and, like, a whole specialty. And, of course, there's things to improve upon and build and do all those things. But we're really trying to honor that and, like, the work and just the labor of love that everybody has poured into this organization to make it what it is, to be there for families and for kids and for professionals.
It really is such a labor of love. And it started with one family who had nowhere to turn. And
and should have had, as Shannon likes to say, she should have had people lined up to help her.
Yes.
In terms of, like, when we think about resources and availability of resources, you know, and that's why we really do try to think about, like, those that can't pay for services or don't have the access. She always says she should have had people lined up and she didn't. And that is when she knew that it was, like, a huge problem that needed to be solved at a global level.
There was literally nowhere for Shannon Goldwater to go.
Yeah.
So I think that just speaks volumes. You know, when you have someone that has means and support and connections, and there's not a single place for her to go to get help. I mean, and to look at how far we've come in 20 years, there's not enough providers and there's not enough education happening, but we've made huge strides. And that's a huge testament to you, Jacqueline, and the team you've built and the coalition of parents and providers you've built throughout the country. It's amazing.
They're such powerhouse volunteers and passionate champions. Mm-hmm. I'm inspired by our community every single day.
Yes, exactly. Parents need to, I think the one thing I would add is that, you know, parents need to remember that this is not their fault and that there are places to go to ask for help and that there's no shame in this. I think there's a lot of pressure on parents in the age of social media and, you know, there's just so much information overload from non-clinicians on social media about how to be a good parent. And I think there's like a lot of shame involved in all of this. So what I would tell parents is, follow your instincts and believe in your instincts and don't feel any shame and fight for help, you know, and sort of be an advocate and don't be afraid to challenge the status quo or challenge what you're hearing from your providers if it's not aligned with what your gut instinct is telling you, and go find someone else, you know, and there's no shame in that. And I felt shame in that. And that's why it took me so long to do it, is because I felt sort of ashamed to challenge what my pediatrician was telling me. Mm. But had I done that much sooner, we would have made earlier progress.
Yeah, it's okay to listen to that gut instinct, even though you've got people telling you to wait.
Mm-hmm. Because the reality is, again, that, like, I think pediatricians are all coming from a good place and they're all
They very much are.
Yeah. And so I don't at all want to villainize pediatricians, but the reality is that many of them, I think, still don't know. what makes it.
Yeah. So, and there's just been so many myths for so long that they probably are still buying into that it is just a phase, or there's pickiness in kids, or all the different things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that this can be such a precursor to so many other things. You know, it can be a sign of autism, but it's not kind of many other developmental delays and serious sensory processing issues. And, you know, if you take this seriously and get help early, then you can also get the other diagnoses you need early and sort of get this wraparound service that is so fundamental to the overall care you need for your kid.
Well, Liz, we so appreciate you. And it's just, we're just so grateful to all the support that you've given us, and the champion that you are for this issue is just really incredible.
Parent too. Yeah, I'm so glad that you're here for so many other parents that need you. And we're so lucky to have you right here in Arizona. From my perspective, that was huge. And I hope that we can find ways for families and parents to find you when they need you.
Yeah, that is the goal for sure. Definitely. Thank you so much for coming on, for chatting with us a little bit. Yeah. Thanks, everyone. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.